This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
In February of 1959, Fidel Castro became the Prime Minister of Cuba. Since that time, he has apparently survived over 600 assassination attempts, or so they say. Among them, an exploding cigar, an exploding seashell, a poisoned milkshake, LSD, and thallium salts that would make all his hair fall out. No, that wasn't just the unused plot for an episode of Get Smart. The Cold War was in full swing, and the CIA seemed to be obsessed with killing Castro. The best way to protect the American homeland, you see, was to quite simply do away with the communist revolutionary. Killing Castro, however, was much easier said than done. The United States couldn't just assassinate him due to Article 51 of the UN Charter, a troublesome clause which bans UN members from attacking one another. And so the only way the CIA could do this was to come up with a way that would allow them to invoke plausible deniability.
In Havana, acting Foreign Minister Olivares shows diplomats rockets fired from the Cuban raiders, which he claims have U.S. markings. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, Cuban Foreign Minister Roa accused the United States of unleashing a war of invasion. Roa says the invading soldiers trained in Florida, but Ambassador Stevenson makes a quick denial.
These charges are totally false, and I deny them categorically.
So it's the spring of 1963, and the CIA comes up with yet another cunning plan. It supposedly involved presenting Castro with a poisoned wetsuit, which was to be delivered by James B. Donovan, an American lawyer sent by JFK to negotiate the release of the Bay of Pigs prisoners. And so the CIA's Technical Services Division duly purchases a wetsuit and contaminates the breathing apparatus with tubercle bacilli and the suit itself with fungus spores, which would cause a chronic skin disease called Madura foot. They didn't, however, consider two rather elementary points. The fact that it was, in effect, a gift from the United States, the idea, after all, was to keep it secret, or, more importantly, Donovan's feeling about being the gift giver in this plot. So I read this great story about the CIA and how they wanted to poison Castro using a wetsuit, and they wanted to use your dad to do it. Is that true?
There was an incident that was exactly as you said. And my father was always a kind of defender of the CIA in the sense that some people back in that era were talking as though we didn't really need a spy agency. But he would always tell people that it's just as necessary today as having an army. But at the same time, he would recognize that there were some people who were, you know, wise and strategic thinkers in the CIA, and there are other people who would do things that seemed half crazy. I think some of this kind of activity with regard to assassination was in that latter category, and so apparently he heard that something might go wrong with this wetsuit idea. You see, he used to ask CIA to provide him with certain things that he would make gifts of to Castro, and so he asked them to provide a wetsuit, but then he just went out himself and bought his own wetsuit, or had somebody do it that knows how to buy those things, and that's what we brought along. And we were out on a fishing boat with Castro, and there he was with that wetsuit. And so in retrospect, it interests me to think back that anybody would think about making my father an unwitting accomplice to an assassination like that, because, you know, he wouldn't have survived it. I wouldn't have survived it. The world would have been back on the brink of World War III, perhaps, because this was right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was also shocking because my father actually had been a legal architect of the CIA going back during World War II, when he was general counsel of the first unified spy agency that existed in the United States right before the end of the war. It was like putting one of your own people, in a way, in mortal danger.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware.
think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan, and that just there was John Donovan.
I'm John Donovan, son of James Donovan, played by Tom Hanks in Bridge of Spies.
His father, James B. Donovan, was the protagonist of Steven Spielberg's latest effort, Bridge of Spies, which tells the story in true Capra-esque fashion of the Brooklyn attorney who defended Rudolf Abel, a man accused of being a Russian spy during the Cold War. The movie, however, only tells you that one story, that one tiny part of a truly extraordinary life. Today, to find out more, to find out who James Donovan really was, to find out what made him tick and what kept him inspired and motivated, I'm speaking to his children, Jane, John, and Mary Ellen.
Singing songs and a carry inside. Mostly say hooray for our side.
James Donovan died on January 19th, 1970, in Brooklyn, New York. He was just 53 years old. But in those years, this insurance lawyer had faced down Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, KGB officers, and Fidel Castro. He was the most successful American practitioner of meta-diplomacy during the Cold War, someone who could operate above and beyond the usual diplomatic channels to disarm the world's best jugglers of words and ideas. So your father seemed to have this phenomenal understanding of geopolitics. He had this ability to see how world events, not how they were playing out, but how they were about to play out. And it seems, even from the film, that he was constantly playing this long game. Did you see that in him growing up, this consummate strategist?
There were certain elements of that that were discernible, because very early in his career, you know, right out of law school, he participated in very high-level situations pertaining to World War II. That itself gave him a broader perspective at a young age. Another factor is that some people may think that the insurance business is something that's very narrow, and in fact, he always thought of it as quite the opposite, because of the way that it interacted with every other kind of industry in the country or even abroad. He represented some foreign companies as well. And so he always had that kind of breadth of vision. And plus, he was very diversified. He didn't just think about law and things like that all the time. He had an interest in books and literature and fine bindings and a number of other things of a cultural nature.
My father's study was like an axis. Everybody came to it.
That was James Donovan's daughter, Mary Ellen.
He would say to me, "Now, Mary Ellen, you know, Shirley Chisholm is coming over this evening. Put on a nice dress. You can greet her at the door and bring her a glass of sherry." And this is the way we met the world. Hugh Carey was considering running for governor, and he came over. Nicholas Katzenbach, who became Attorney General of the United States, he would come over. Jimmy Breslin, the famous writer. It was a lot of fun. Our home was very, very busy. So whether he was getting a phone call from Castro or running for a Senate seat, all those phone calls would come into the house. It was very busy.
James Donovan would defend Rudolf Abel. He would negotiate the release of Francis Gary Powers, a U-2 pilot shot down and held captive in the Soviet Union. He would work in the shadows to prevent an international crisis. He would effectively prevent the Cold War from getting hot. And all of that is rather brilliantly depicted in the film. What you don't see, however, is what came after, because James Donovan wasn't quite done with the geopolitics of the day. So as the movie ends, we get this postscript about Cuba and about how President Kennedy sent your dad to save 1,000 people and he ends up freeing over 9,000. It's interesting, when we were watching it over here, as that final postscript unfolded, there was an audible gasp in the cinema. You know, for 2.5 hours, you're watching this film, you kind of get lost in the fact that it's a Steven Spielberg movie, and you forget that it's real. And then it kind of hits home again that, hey, this was a real man and he's done some pretty cool things and he saved a lot of lives. And I think that was a really fascinating aspect. But we left the cinema wondering about Cuba. So I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about Cuba and what your father did there.
Yes. Well, the Kennedy administration was responsible for sending exiles from Miami, Florida, into Cuba to try to overthrow Castro, and that Bay of Pigs invasion failed in 1961, but Castro had captured about 1,150 men and put them in a dungeon, and the Kennedys had no idea about how to get them out, and the families of those men were going around the United States trying to raise money to pay Castro a ransom. So the Kennedys then suggested to the families who were having no success raising that money that they go up and talk to my father. So my father went down to Cuba, and he quickly negotiated a situation in which Castro would accept pharmaceutical products rather than cash. So then he went around. He happened to have some friends in the, who were chief executives in pharmaceutical companies, major ones, and he made all of that happen. It took about 13 different trips down to Cuba, but finally, by the end of 1962, that was accomplished. The men came home, 1,150 plus about 8,000 of their relatives who were being really oppressed down there in that situation. So now here's something about it that was similar to the movie. In the movie, he could have settled for just getting Powers out in exchange for Abel, but he didn't want to just settle for that. He wanted the best possible outcome, which was to get another American named Frederick Pryor out. Well, it's a little bit similar to that in the Cuba situation, because he could have just settled for getting all of those Bay of Pigs people out, but he didn't settle for that. He heard about 35 American citizens not connected with the Bay of Pigs who were still down there, and he wanted to get them out. And so that's when he took me, his 18-year-old son, down there. We traveled across Cuba by car with Castro, and we came home with 35 U.S. prisoners.
That must have been surreal, meeting Castro at 18 years old.
It was. He, in my view, looking back on it, making quite an appeal through my father to the Kennedys. He really wanted to restore relations even back then, 52 years ago. Not, I think, because he was any more, you know, democratic, but because he wanted, I think, to play off the Soviet Union with the United States. And so he was showing us proudly what he thought of as the various achievements of his revolution.
I'm assuming that must have been as difficult a period with regards to public opinion as the whole Colonel Abel incident, given how the American media was treating Cuba and Castro at the time. I mean, people must not have looked upon your dad kindly. And what was that like for you kids at home?
Well, your perception about that is accurate, but we had implicit faith in him and my father about all of this. And it wasn't as bad, because after all, if you see people on television who are coming home after 15 months in a dungeon, you know, you'd have to be a fairly hard-hearted kind of a person to be critical of him.
After this, I speak to Jane, John, and Mary Ellen about the movie Bridge of Spies and whether or not Hollywood has done right by them. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
In 1957, convicted Russian spy Rudolf Abel was sentenced to 30 years, escaping the death penalty after his attorney argued that the United States might want to swap Abel for an American at some future time. Now, Abel has been exchanged for U-2 pilot Gary Powers. Powers was sentenced by Russia to 10 years in 1960, and only weeks ago wrote his family that he had little hope of an early release. But negotiations between the two governments bore fruit. Since his release, Powers was not immediately available for photographs.
Paper bag was on my knee. Man, I had a dream.
USSR. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Umar Paganam, P.K. Pagan, and today I'm speaking to the Donovans, Jane, John, and Mary Ellen, the children of Brooklyn lawyer James Donovan, portrayed by Tom Hanks in the Steven Spielberg film Bridge of Spies.
Oh, my. Well, I'm embarrassed to tell you. I've seen it 8 times. And I'm going to see it for a 9th time. And basically, it's because I love movie theaters and seeing things on a big screen. And what has happened is it's made it very real for me. You know, once it gets out on DVD, it's over. You know, it's in with the rest of the DVDs. But when you see it on the big screen, it's just shockingly wonderful. And it's a way of reminding myself that this really did happen. I think my favorite scene was when they were on the bridge and the car pulls up. And Abel gets out of the car a little bemused and looking around. And all of a sudden, he simply says, "Jim, I tell you, I cry every time." Just saying the word Jim, the way he said it, it said volumes. It just said volumes when he says the word Jim. I don't know. It just strikes me. But my father was like that. I mean, he went in, and this is the key, Oma, is that he went in as a private citizen. And so he wasn't representing a government, and that's what got the deal done. So that's why Kennedy also wanted him to go into the Bay of Pigs as a private citizen. He was a lawyer for the parents of the kids that were in prison. He didn't come in representing the U.S. government. And that's what turned the tide. So it kept everything, that tenuous thread just always stayed in, even during the missile crisis. And the private citizen aspect was important. And of course, Castro is a very smart man, very intelligent. And so they had a lot of late nights sparring with each other.
Jane Donovan was 14 years old when her father took on the task of defending a Russian spy.
Hello, I'm Jane Donovan Amorosi. And after so many years, we never thought something would happen like this. And we are so proud and so excited about hearing about my father and that everyone in the country and other countries are learning about his life and what he did. In the movie, I'm the young girl that has curlers in her hair and she goes under a table because there are gunshots that come through the window, you know?
Right.
Remember that scene? Yes, that's me. That's me, because I was at that time in 1957, I was 14 years old. I was born in 1943, and so during the war, and so we didn't see a lot of our father during the war because he was mostly in England, in England, Germany, Switzerland, those places, because he was in the OSS, the Secret Service. Obviously, we didn't know some of these things ahead of time. The one thing that I knew that no one else knew immediately was I immediately knew what was going to happen because I was standing next to him. We were away. He liked some beautiful mountain country that we used to go to in upstate New York, beautiful lakes, beautiful mountains, and that was in his family history, and he loved going there. So I was with my mother and father, just myself, my mother and my father, on vacation there. Sister and brother were away somewhere else, and a phone call came from the judge saying that they had just captured this spy and that they had had a meeting and had decided that my father was the right person to take on this job. So he got off the phone for a moment and he said, "This is what's happening and I have to decide very soon in the near future what to do." You know that he decided within a couple of hours? He went out, he got some fresh air, walked around for a while, came home to the house and said, "I've made my decision, I'm going to do this." And most people would agonize over this for a while because a couple of people that he mentioned it to said, "Why would you do that? Why do you need to do that?" He just had this in him. He just, you know, felt that he had to do it. Everything he did was like that. Very challenging.
The three of them, Jane, John, and Mary Ellen, had two very contrasting experiences growing up with their father. At one point, they were the children of one of the most reviled men in America. And at another, they were suddenly the children of a national hero. It would happen over and again. First, during the Rudolf Abel incident, and then when James Donovan was sent to negotiate with Fidel Castro. Here's Mary Ellen again.
Well, I will say that we were in an apartment building, and every morning in my little uniform, I'd head out the door for school, and I was always ducking picketers. We were picketed three different times. You know, commie lover, and they're all screaming, and everybody's hateful as could be, and I just gaily wave at them. We did it again when he was president of the Board of Education of New York City during busing and integration. It was a terrible time. And, you know, we went through that again. And then he was also president of Pratt Institute during student uprising. So again, the picketers came out.
How did he, or what motivated him to stay the course? He knew in his heart what he was doing was right, but it seemed like everyone else was telling him otherwise. And it took a while before they all came around.
Well, truthfully, this is, I don't know if I'm getting off course in what I'm going to tell you, but I feel that his home life, his parents, were the most amazing people. I think that he got a lot of his life values from them and from the family. And he lived in a, you know what a row house is, don't you? A townhouse, you know, sort of a tall house with, you know, four or five floors in it. And he had quite an active family life at home. And they were interesting people. They believed in doing things for other people. And his father was a doctor. He would see patients in the home during the day. Later in the day, his mother taught music lessons to children in the neighborhood. So then they would come in for the music lessons. And then in the evening, they would have meetings, either things to do with things going on in the neighborhood where they lived or things that had to do with politics. For that time in life, they were very interesting people. And I believe that a lot of his life and his values came from his home life.
I'm speaking to Jane, John, and Mary Ellen about their father, James Donovan, whom you would have seen played by Tom Hanks in the movie Bridge of Spies. When we come back, I ask them what it was like being raised by Atticus Finch. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Looking at all the life, there were plants and birds and rocks and things, there were sand and hills and rain.
Your dad must have been shattered when JFK was shot.
Yes, very much so. He loved John Kennedy, loved him. He really did think he was the most able of all the Kennedys, and that he had an overview. Wasn't so intense that he couldn't see people's opposite sides, that he couldn't experience what somebody else was going through. He wasn't a dogged person. He was a man who understood human nature and kept an open mind. And my father loved that about him.
You're listening to The Evening Edition, and I'm Uma Paganamke Pagan. The brand new Steven Spielberg movie, Bridge of Spies, tells the story of Brooklyn insurance lawyer James Donovan, a civilian who was sent to East Germany during the height of the Cold War to negotiate the release of Francis Gary Powers, a downed U-2 pilot who was being held captive in the Soviet Union.
It's all about this man and what he represents. He's a threat to all of us, a traitor. Who's a traitor?
The Rosenbergs were traitors.
Who were they?
That's your sister's.
They gave atomic secrets to the Russians. They were Americans. They betrayed their country. But you can't accuse Abel of being a traitor. He's not an American.
Oh, listen to yourself. You're defending him already.
I'm hungry.
You're rehearsing it on me. You said you were just thinking about
it. I am just thinking about it. It's very hard. Everyone deserves a defense. Every person matters.
Jim, what do we deserve? Do you know how people will look at us? The family of a man trying to free a traitor?
It's a brilliant movie, but one that merely teases the life story of this American patriot. Watching the film, I couldn't help but feel like I wanted to know more. Watching the film, I couldn't help but wonder what it must have been like for James Donovan's children, Jane, John, and Mary Ellen. I couldn't help but wonder what it must have been like being raised by Atticus Finch. So I asked him. I have this picture in my head that you, your brother, and your sister were all raised by Atticus Finch.
Well, that's true. That's very true. And as a matter of fact, now that you've said that, when he wrote his book, his memoirs called Strangers on a Bridge, and it's just been reissued by Scribner's, it was interesting because MGM bought the rights back in 64, and Gregory Peck was to play my father.
No way.
He had just won the Academy Award for Atticus Finch. And he said, oh, that was a fictional lawyer, so now I'd love to tackle this. And Dad and I spent 3 days with him over in London. And he was wooing us, and he's a lovely, understated man. And he wanted to play my father, and Alec Guinness was going to play Abel, and Peter Ustinov wrote the screenplay. And he would come to the house several times. So it's interesting that you bring up the name Atticus Finch.
Here's Jane.
I think that's probably right. I think you're probably right about that. This was an amazing, amazing man who, his life, to use a term from today, fast forward would apply to someone like this, because he squeezed more into 53 years, and it was many lifetimes for most people, you know. It was just amazing how he lived and how he did so much to impact this country, our country, and other people as well, and in addition, do good things for people. He really, and I mean people, all people.
So tell me about your father. I think we know about his accomplishments. We know about James Donovan, the national hero. But what was he like as a man? What was he like as a father?
Well, I think that the movie portrayal is good at the personal level, in the sense that he always came across as a man of great conviction. And he was, in fact, always, often up, just appalled at some of the nonsense that would go on in society and the like. And he, you know, expected us to grow up as people of principle. And that's the way he was. And at the same time, he did actually spend quite a bit of time away from home. But then he would sort of make up for that by taking my two sisters and I as individuals on different trips. And so, as a matter of fact, there was one trip, for instance, that he took me over to London and Zurich at a time when, right after Powers was shot down, there's a possibility of meeting with some of the people who are, in fact, portrayed in the movie. On another occasion, he took me down to Cuba, and we came back with 35 prisoners that he negotiated from Fidel Castro.
He also took you on his visits to see Colonel Abel, so you kind of saw firsthand their relationship. What was that like?
I think that the portrayal in the movie was very good, in the sense that Abel was a very understated kind of a quiet person. On one of those trips over there to the federal prison in central Manhattan, we actually sang a little song to him around Christmas time, to the tune of the Christmas song called Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because his name is Rudolph Abel, and we made up some funny words. And so Abel would laugh, you know, a little bit, but he was not a very emotional kind of a person. He was generally quiet. But those were nice and interesting visits to think back on.
I've come across a lot of people with illustrious parents, and, you know, with parents who do things for the sake of the nation. Were you at any point ever conflicted about your father's work? Because I'm sure it must have taken a toll on the family.
Actually not, because, you know, when you think about it, between the OSS and Nuremberg and a Russian spy and a U.S. Senate race in Cuba and Board of Ed and Pratt, I mean, he died at 53 years old. And he had done all of those varying things. I had the opportunity to go down to the Bay of Pigs Museum in Miami for the 50th anniversary of the release and to give a talk, to give a speech. And most of the brigade members were there. And I have to say, between the movie and my visit to the brigade, I feel like my father's, yet again, 45 years later, he's taking us on an adventure. People clasped my hands down in Little Havana in Miami and looked me square in the eye and said, I pray for your father every day. Every day.
More with Jane, John, and Mary Ellen in just a little bit. This is The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
What was your favorite part of the movie, Uma?
It was those quiet moments when it was just your dad facing off, or rather Tom Hanks facing off with different people. That moment when he pulls the aide aside, that moment in the street when he has to confront those ruffians. The moment in that bar when he talks to the guy from the CIA, I think those moments kind of capture character. And I'm hoping to God that they got it right.
Well, they did, because I have seen it 8 times and I'm going to see it the 9th time this Thursday in Charleston, South Carolina. They're asking me for a Q&A and showing the movie. So one thing I've discovered, it's been a roller coaster that every time I see the movie, I react very differently. And I would say about the 3rd or 4th time I saw it, my whole being was missing my father, just missing him terribly. And that made me understand how clear it is to me how Tom Hanks got it right. Tom Hanks nailed it. Have you seen Tom Hanks' YouTube where he's interviewed about my father's character?
Yes, I have.
And it takes my breath away. Absolutely takes my breath away. But to see it on the big screen and to know how much I miss him, that told me what a great job he had done.
You're listening to The Evening Edition, and I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan. I'm speaking today to Jane, John, and Mary Ellen about their father, James Donovan, the real-life Brooklyn lawyer played by Tom Hanks in the movie Bridge of Spies. It's so rare that we see a movie which celebrates patriots who use words as their weapons, and rather than using weapons as weapons.
I think it's being well-received because it's a thinking man's movie. Thinking woman's movie, because there's so much animation and shoot 'em up going on, and to actually pay strict attention to the words being used. I mean, Matt Sharman wrote a fabulous screenplay, and I'm sure the Coens, you know, entered in some marvelous humor in this as well, which was really another element of my father. He was an Irishman with a great sense of humor and a good sense of irony. You know, that's why when they keep saying, can't we just call it Russia? Can't we just simplify what we're saying here? That was the humor in him, you know?
I think your father had a tremendous capacity, not for tolerance, but for being able to relate to people. In Colonel Abel, he seemed to see the same qualities he had, patriotism, loyalty, a sense of duty. That was a gift.
Well, when he would sit in the study and we were speaking, he basically really stuck to the framework that this is a man who loved his country, and he's really highly educated, very intelligent. My father had respect for that. And at the same time, Dad knew he was standing facing him, and he loved his country, and he was intelligent. So it really was something to relish that these two men were on similar calibers, and it meant a great deal to him that at least if he's going to do battle, it's with somebody who warrants it.
I read this article where you said that one of your proudest moments was at your father's wake. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was. Because the other thing is, I don't know whether I should mention this or not, but I think so.
That, once again, is Jane Donovan.
In the United States, you know that years ago there was quite a bit of bias about Black Americans, you know, that they lived in neighborhoods and a lot of white people didn't necessarily go to, you know, but not my father. My father went to a section of Brooklyn, New York, called Bedford-Stuyvesant, and it was not a good neighborhood. You know, most people didn't go there, but my father did, and he had a lot of friends there, and he did a lot to help people. He was involved in their civic affairs, and he tried to help them and found community centers and different things, and he was a very caring person. So the reason I'm telling you that is because at his part of his funeral service, there were Black Americans kneeling in front of his casket, and there were Cuban Americans. And I thought to myself, this speaks volumes about this man. Here he is, an Irish American man, Irish Catholic American. So I was very proud, but that's what I saw at his casket.
So, John, after all of these years, I take it the movie has done good by you and your family.
Oh, it's been a miracle for us. We are absolutely thrilled by it. We were dismayed in previous years that some people didn't even know, who Francis Gary Power was, or who Abel was, or who my father was, or they had forgotten about it. And now the real significance of it, especially the character part of it, holding someone up as a person of conviction and character, that part of it is wonderful.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come.
I've been speaking to Jane, John, and Mary Ellen about their late father, James Donovan. He is played by Tom Hanks in the Steven Spielberg movie Bridge of Spies, which I believe is still in cinemas. If you missed any part of this program, you can download the podcast, as always, on BFM.my.
Cause out on the edge of darkness, there is a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. About the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun.
Dad loved it. When I started out, I'd listen to him talk about Abel, and I took his legal paper and I drew with crayons a picture of a tall, skinny man with horizontal black and white stripes. And he had a matching hat and a ball and chain. And then on the side of the paper, I wrote, "My dad works for him."
This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bring your good friends too, cause it's getting nearer. It soon will be with you. Come and join the living. It's not so far from you. And it's getting nearer. Soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounded louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Come on, peace train, peace train.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss?
Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again.
Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Come on.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.